Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today I have in studio, at the beginning of the program, Brent Black. He is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. And we'd love to hear from you with your questions or comments. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And among other topics, we're going to look at some of the cold issues, and which is interesting because I think last time we were talking about some of the warming issues. So what's happened in the last month?
And the two go together. We've had the warm that we had in February and March has set us up for some cold issues now that we're in April. We've had, as you know, last week here in Cache Valley, we had a big snowstorm, and I was getting a lot of calls, people nervous about what is all this storm doing to my fruit trees. And funny enough, it wasn't the snowstorm that did the damage that we're seeing. It was actually the cold weather that we had before, back on the 3rd and 4th of April. That was when we had that cold snap where it was clear and cold and got down into the mid to low 20s, and that caused more damage than what the snow did.
And back then, the damage was in what? In apricots and, well, plums?
Depending on where you are in the state, as you go further south, there was damage to sweet cherries, to some of the early peaches, the peaches that were moving further earlier along. We actually even saw some damage to apples, and the apples were weeks away from bloom, but the unopened flowers were damaged. In fact, what we've seen is we've seen a lot of damage to the kingflower. So we've talked in the past about thinning in apples. They were just a little bit further along, and so none of them had opened yet, but they were in what's called tight cluster stage. We saw damage to the king blooms, where in some varieties we're seeing essentially all of the king blooms were damaged, and some of the earlier side blooms were damaged as well. And that was primarily in that early April freeze. It's variable from area to area in terms of how much damage happened this last week when we had the snowstorm come through, because in some areas where the snow quit and cleared off in the middle of the night, then bud temperatures dropped quite dramatically, whereas if it was snowy and overcast and then cleared off during the day, then everything was fine. I've been out looking at some of my neighbors' trees in my neighborhood here in Logan, and even though most of them were in bloom when that snowstorm came, I'm having a hard time finding a lot of damage from that. The ones that were late enough in development that didn't get hit that first week came through pretty well.
So is that because in northern Utah we just happened to have the cloud cover that night and the moisture in the air?
Yeah, kind of a couple things that happened. One thing is, as I was watching the temperatures and weather conditions pretty carefully, and what happened in particularly in Cache Valley, but in northern Utah, the far northern Wasatch Front and up into Cache Valley, was that we had a fairly high dew point. So the snow is falling, the temperature drops down to what the dew point is, and then it stays there pretty constant, and in our case that was about 30-31, which was warm enough that didn't, even though the flowers are covered in snow, their temperature is 31 or 32 degrees, which is not enough to cause damage at that stage.
And that was not what was forecast.
Right.
I was seeing a lot lower temperatures than that,
right.
I figured I'm done.
And ironically, the snow is what protected the flowers. If it hadn't been snowing and it had cleared off and dropped down to what they were projecting, it would have been a lot more serious.
So as you're talking about the king blossom, as you're looking at the cluster, the king blossom is that first one to open. It's also usually produces the largest
So it's fruit. It's genetically has the capability to grow the largest. It usually has more cells. It has a larger pedicel, so there's more vascular tissue going to it. So generally that becomes the dominant flower or the dominant fruit. So it's the first one out. If it gets pollinated well, it starts to grow and gets a head start on the rest, and then the rest are more likely to drop off during June drop. And that in the case what we're seeing this year is that king bloom got damaged, and even some of the first lateral blooms. There's kind of a hierarchy. Not all of the laterals come out at the same time, and it's the latest ones that tended to set the fruit. And unfortunately, those have less potential to size. So there will be some compensation for the fact that the other fruit flowers were damaged, and so that fruit will have more potential to grow than it normally does, but it's already starting off behind, and typically there's only so much it can do to catch up. So you'll see smaller fruit size in general.
Is there an area of the state that was hit harder than others? I'm hoping in northern Utah, maybe we just weren't far enough along with the apples for really much damage
to
happen.
So it's, I haven't looked at a lot of apples in Cache Valley, but at the Kaysville farm, we're looking at apples there recently, and it's variety dependent. We're having a hard time finding viable fruitlets and flowers in the Fuji, and the Galas and the Goldens look great. And it's a variety thing. It's not so much, it's partly bloom date, but it's also just how tolerant those flowers on that variety are to a little bit of real borderline cold. And when you say areas of the state, I was in a block of peaches on Tuesday walking through. This is one of our research blocks.
And in Kaysville?
No, this was actually down in Utah County.
Okay.
And we were seeing, and it's on a farm that's not particularly prone to frost. And the grower that runs the farm said, this has been one of our worst years just because of how cold it got. And as we were walking down the row of peaches, at one section of the row, we're having a hard time finding any viable fruit developing. And then you go 50 feet down the row and we're going to have to thin them. There's so many fruit developing.
Wow.
And it's just, the patterns are so variable. I mean, from one, in a residential situation, you might have somebody's yard where they came through great, and a few blocks away, a completely different story. It's when you get down to those critical temperatures, it can vary so much from one spot to another. It's really hard to predict.
So missing the king blossom in an apple hopefully just means that you're not going to have large apples. They'll be smaller, but
right,
hopefully you'll still have some.
And what's going to happen with some of those is, as we were looking at percentage damage on the flowers, in the past, we've talked about the importance of thinning to get your fruit load down early so that you can.
And that has to be done
bloom
by what, mid-May, end of May?
Well, it depends on development. So this year it would be earlier than normal if we'd have gotten good fruit set. But usually when the fruitlets, the king fruitlets, are about the size of your thumb, you've got to get in and start thinning. And this year, with some of those where we've assessed flower damage, we're probably not going to need any thinning. We're going to probably be a moderate to a light crop without any thinning at all. Whereas, so the good news in that scenario is that we're going to have good flowering next year. Well, the trees will be set up. The bad news is if we have varieties that are prone to biennial bearing that fall into this pattern very easily, we've just basically synchronized them all so that they're all going to be heavy next year and light the next if we don't take corrective action next spring, in spring of 2016.
And normally you would be thinning out, so one every 6 to 8 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've got four or five clusters all together, you're going to be just picking one apple out of all of those blossoms,
right?
Anyway.
So in actual practice, you've got spurs where each cluster is on a spur, and ideally you want one fruit per spur, and only half of the spurs or less to be producing fruit in any given year, so that the other spurs are resting one year, they're not producing a fruit, so that they can flower and fruit the next year.
And this holds true for most, you know, for the pom fruits, apples and pears. Mm-hmm. Does it hold true for stone fruits?
So not so much. You don't get that kind of feedback inhibition. And primarily that's because in the case of stone fruits, they have a different type of bud, and the buds are located on different kinds of wood. So on, for example, peaches, the flower buds are on the growth that occurred last year. And so usually you have ample flower buds produced. And on cherries, you'll get spurs that on the second and third year wood. And the danger there with cherries is if you get too many flowers one year, then you don't have enough spurs for the next year. Because the first year, ideally with, say, a sweet cherry, you're going to have a cluster of leaves the first year from that bud. And that forms a small spur that has multiple flower buds the next year. And if you have too many flower buds on that younger wood, you get blind nodes. You don't get the spur forming. And that that's the challenge. So it's a different type of flower bud, and it's a different position on the tree where you get those flowers and fruit forming.
I've never thought of this before, but I've not really heard of thinning cherries.
So yeah, so the question, that's a good point. And so thinning with cherries, you don't thin for biennality. You don't try and thin to get fruit every year like you do with the pome fruit. But if you have too heavy of a cherry crop, you're gonna reduce your size, and you're gonna reduce your quality because it's leaves that are producing the energy mm-hmm. that's forming the sugars and flavor compounds that we're all after, and pigments, so the coloring. So what commercial growers will do is they will prune out some of the fruiting wood, and so they're thinning by pruning. They're actually pruning out some of the wood that has a potential to produce a lot of fruit to reduce the total tree crop load and get better size and better quality.
With peaches and apricots, I'm thinking you have to thin at least as far as if you've got too much fruit hanging out on the end, because you don't want your branches mm-hmm. too much of a load.
So that's a good point. So we talk about different principles of pruning, where we get strong crotch angles, where we keep the fruiting wood back close to the scaffold, so there's not all this leverage, and so that part of thinning for peaches is also pruning back to leave the small fruiting laterals close to the scaffolds where the tree can support them. You know, I was visiting with some colleagues during the snowstorm this past week, and they said, well, what are we learning? What's this going to do to the fruit trees? And I said, well, the first thing it's going to do is show us where we've pruned poorly, because all that wet snow is going to pull off any branch that has a weak crotch angle. And sure enough, that's exactly what we saw in some areas, mm-hmm. branches coming out of trees. That keeping the crop load back where the tree can support it is one of the objectives that we talk about when we're talking about kind of pruning principles.
Kind of a side question here regarding stone fruits. So with peaches, when you first put in a peach, I mean, they sometimes can produce a few peaches the next year, mm-hmm. but I've heard that that's not always the best thing to do, is to allow them to fruit, to pull the fruit off.
So The one of the things that we've done recently as horticulturists is we've select for varieties that are more precocious, meaning they want to flower and fruit earlier in their life cycle. And that has a lot of benefits, but it has to be managed. And if we let the plant put too much energy into fruit, it will slow down. It's basically its resources have to go somewhere. And if they're going into fruit, they're not going into adequate root development, adequate scaffold branch growth. And we see with some varieties that are quite precocious, and particularly on very precocious rootstocks, if we let them fruit too soon, they'll stunt out and they'll never grow the tree that we want. So during the first few years, we may want no fruit, or we want to keep the crop load very, very light until that tree has kind of filled the space that we want it to fill, till it's reached the height and established the scaffolds that we want. And then we can let it settle down and start to fruit.
So that apple I planted 4 years ago that has yet to produce an apple, it's been long enough now. Doesn't produce anything this year.
So hopefully what you did last year was bend some of the branches horizontal, and that would have stimulated flower bud initiation. And then as the fruit set and the tree starts to put more of its energy into fruit, then that'll actually stimulate more fruiting branches and less vegetative branches and bring that tree into balance so that it's fruiting.
So how does the tree know if it doesn't have a good crotch angle, it doesn't bear fruit?
Well, it's not the crotch angle, it's the angle at which the branch is. So that's kind of two different things. If you have a narrow crotch angle, you get bark inclusions, and you mm-hmm. get a weak branch in terms of being able to support a load. But if the branch is relatively upright, it has to do with hormone transport within the branch. But if it's relatively upright, nearly all of those buds are going to be vegetative. And as you bend it to horizontal, then more and more of them will be reproductive and less will be vegetative. And if you bend it below horizontal, then the tree wants to put its growth somewhere else. And so you get water sprouts popping up, or you get growth somewhere else on the tree. So it's always a balancing act. You want some vegetative vigor going into that branch, but you want it not so vigorous that it's going to form flower buds.
So that's what happens when you're pruning too much.
Pruning too much. If you're
water sprouts pop up.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens is if you've got it in your lawn and you're trying to compete with your neighbor to have the greenest lawn, you're probably putting too much nitrogen on there for that tree. And it's all that nitrogen is represents vigor that's got to go somewhere. That tree is wants to grow somewhere. And if you're bending branches down, it's going to send water sprouts and different things. So a combination of how heavily you prune it and also how much nitrogen fertilizer it's getting, which is the predominant element that you're applying to your lawn to make it nice and green.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension, almost said entomologist. No, that would be Diane. Extension fruit specialist. And you can join our conversation with your questions or comment at 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So is it too late to prune?
Well, it depends on what. And really, the later you prune, the less of that vigor that you're going to get back. So in some situations, it's a good idea to summer prune. So you're taking out vegetative growth, and that slows the tree down. But dormant pruning, the later you wait, the less vigor response you're going to get. I things get away from me on some of my research plots, so I was pruning some tart cherries on Monday. So that's later than I really wanted because they were in bloom. But we're still going to get some vigor push from that, but not as much as we would have if we'd have pruned 3 weeks ago or a month ago. In the case of things like grapes, they haven't started to push. Before the program, we were talking about, you know, a lot of people, I'll get these calls. People will say, well, I pruned my grapes and now all this stuff is coming out. It's weeping out of the cut. Am I killing the grapevine? Actually, that's a sign that the vine is healthy. If it's weeping out of the wounds, that's a good thing. And this last week when I pruned my grapevines, there was none of that weeping. And now I'm nervous. I don't know exactly what's going on with them. If it was some damage to the vascular tissue back when we had that cold snap in December, if the vines hadn't completely hardened off, I'm a little bit worried about that. Mm. The other possibility is that my soil moisture it's drier than I thought it was. And I've got to dig a hole down. And, you know, it's when we're talking about grapevines or fruit trees, it's not the roots in the top few inches that matter. It's down 8 inches, 10 inches, a foot, foot and a half. And I need to honestly dig a hole and see how wet the soil is down there, because I may need to start irrigating a lot earlier than I have.
And grapes are one you need to know that, because they don't like to be waterlogged. So
right,
if you just stick a hose
right
on it just to be sure, then
exactly,
you could be exacerbating a problem.
Yeah, grapes are more sensitive to heavy, wet soil. And so I need to figure out what the situation is. And I would suggest, depending on your soil type, we had that snowstorm. We haven't had a lot of spring rains or snows. And so some soils are drier than people think. And so, yeah, you can tell when your grass starts to look dry. But for your fruit trees, you probably want to dig a hole down about a foot and a half and see how wet the soil is down there and see if it's time to start irrigating, because they may be drier than you think.
Mm. Well, and I had almost an inch, about 8/10 in that last storm. But if the profile below was really dry, it didn't get down.
It didn't go
far.
Down very far. Yeah. And that's the surface soils were getting pretty dry. I think on campus, the weather station here that we have, the environmental observatory, was showing close to an inch of actual water out of all the snow that we got. So that's quite a bit. It's significant. But if the soil was already dry, it soaked that up and probably didn't percolate very deeply.
Well, I guess the nice thing is that you don't have to worry about iron chlorosis as much.
Not as much, unless you're jumping the gun on your irrigation. It's the soil is warming up, and I think that's going to be less of an issue than it has been in years where we've seen a lot of April and May rainstorms and kept the soil cool and wet longer.
So talking about pruning grapes, this is a question I get quite often. And people seem really shocked when I tell them exactly how much they need to cut off.
Yeah, that's the part that, again, when you start talking to folks about how much pruning it takes, they're oftentimes very surprised. And the rule of thumb that I like to use for grapes is that you want each bud that's out there now will produce what's called a cane. And you really only want between, depending on how healthy your plant is, how healthy the vine is, you only want between 20 and 40 canes to grow any given year. So if you leave all of that's out there, you're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of buds. You need to get that down to between 20 and 40, depending on how healthy the plant is.
If you've got two rows, so a tier, and then above that, another lateral tier.
Uh-huh.
So you're looking only at 10 buds on each
side. So the tier is called a cordon. So you've got permanent wood that's on two, you've got probably a two-wire trellis, a lower cordon and an upper cordon. And if you've got the cordons going in each direction, you're talking about five buds per cordon on each on the lower. So that brings you to 40 buds right there. Or sorry, if you want 10, but then that'll give you 40. But in the case of a weaker growing, so my grapes are in a little bit of shade.
So
I only keep maybe 15 or 20 of those per vine, because that's really all that vine wants to support. It'll grow more if I let it. But so a weaker vine, a younger vine, you might put five on each cordon, and a healthy one, you're going to put 10. Now, backing up, there's a qualifier that you need to put on that. You want to have 20 to 40 canes growing. That doesn't mean that you go out in January or February and prune back to 40 buds, because some of those are going to be winter killed. Some of them were blind nodes, and so you didn't have a viable bud there. So what I typically do is go out and whack off really 70 or 80% of the growth that happened last year early on, and then come back as the buds start to swell
a little bit.
And if I need to take more out, rub a few buds off if I've got too many. And as they're just starting to grow, you can just basically rub them off and get rid of them that way. And get it down to the numbers that you want. So it's kind of a rough pruning and then a finish pruning, detailed pruning at the end.
For lack of a better word, so I'm talking about my central leader here with my grape. It's going up.
Yeah.
And do you have, what did you call them again, on your laterals?
Cordons.
So are your cordons permanent?
Yes.
Off to the side?
Mm-hmm.
And then each year you get growth out of that
and
cordon.
And you're pruning back to leave spurs on those cordons. So a spur, it's going to grow a cane, it's a big long shoot, and you're going to cut it back to a spur, which is maybe two or three nodes long.
Mm-hmm.
And then one or two of those buds will push and give you the canes for the next year. So you're cutting back to a stub each time.
Do you have, because I know that I've seen videos on the extension website for other things, like I was just watching one the other day for pruning a peach.
Uh-huh.
Do you have anything for pruning a grape?
We don't, but there are some resources out there that show. There's several other state extension services that have pruning guides for grapes. We don't do a lot of grapes in Utah, primarily a home garden. There's a few small vineyards, so we don't develop a lot of resources. But there's information out there that will show you.
I'm assuming
management strategies.
More than likely, I just go to a Google search and type in Concord and pruning.
Yeah.
And
well, so Concord's a different scenario because,
oh no, now you're switching the game on me.
Well, a lot of the commercial Concord are grown as a juice grape, and so they grow lots and lots of acres, and they don't do a lot of detailed pruning. They have machines that go through and just basically hedge off all the growth from last year, and they don't try and detail prune to set a specific number of buds. Because in the case of table grapes, we want to get that crop load down fairly carefully, because otherwise our grapes are going to be really, really small and not very good. So for table grapes, you do a lot more detail. And for wine grapes, they tend to be a lot more careful in terms of getting the bud numbers down to the appropriate level, and then cluster thinning, which is another step. Once they come into bloom and they've started to set fruit, you may want to go through and clip off clusters and get down to fewer clusters, so that they'll size up nice and get the sugar levels that you want. So for if you're growing for table grapes or for wine, you're a lot more careful than if you're just going to pick them all and make juice or jelly.
Which is typically what we would end up doing with them. But still, I have fun finessing it and getting detailed.
We eat ours as table grapes, so I want them to size up.
Your Concord,
up
you do?
Well, I don't grow Concord. I do grow some of the American types, but I grow like Himrod or Niagara or any of those. If I want them for, or if I'm growing Concord to eat fresh, which some people do, then I'm going to manage them a little different than if I'm just going to clip off all the clusters and make juice. Hmm.
So with your green grapes, what's your best green grape for growing in a cold climate?
I grow Himrod, which is a seedless. It's primarily American bunch grape type. It does have, the purists will tell me that it does have vinifera, which is the European type, in it, because all of the seedlessness traits originated in vinifera.
Oh, from that one.
So it's actually an interspecific hybrid, but it's got the slip skin. It's got very much the American type growth habit and characteristics of the American bunch grape.
I just love drinking Concord, especially when I've left it on really long and it just really sweetens up I'm really looking forward to it. We've run out of what we bottled last year. So you've got just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you about pruning and raspberries. Is it too late to prune raspberries?
No, it's not. They're starting to send their primacanes up. Mm-hmm. The floricanes are breaking bud. You know, really to cane out the spent canes, if you're talking about summer bearing types, the best time to take out the spent canes is in the fall. Once they're done, get them out and give more room for primacanes. The risk that you run now is you don't want to damage the emerging primacanes, and you don't want to be knocking a lot of developing shoots off from the canes that you're going to leave behind. So you need to be more careful, but it's not going to hurt it to go in and do it now. You just have to be more careful.
Okay. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we'll have him back again next month. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with our Living with Wildlife segment with Terry Messmer, and we're talking about voles. So stay tuned. This is The Zesty Garden, and it's our Living with Wildlife segment. Terry Messmer is USU's Extension Wildlife Specialist, and today we're going to talk about voles. This is one I'm very familiar with because I see them in my garden all the time. We've been in our place for almost 21 years, and I never used to see vole damage. And then just in the last, I'd say, 7 or 8 years, all of a sudden, boom. I mean, 4 years ago, it was tremendous. I didn't have any carrots because I'd go to dig them up and they had tunneled underneath and had gotten everything.
Okay.
And so now I see more of the damage in lawns. Maybe the lawn was not mowed too short in the fall and they've tunneled underneath it. Our church around the corner, we come out and they're, you just see them running around through there.
Right.
So they look like mice, but they have shorter tails and a more short snout.
Right, smaller ears and just basically a more compact body built, and that's again designed for kind of what their activities are in terms of their tunneling and what areas they frequent. I mean, the idea is that their coloration designs so that they can be fairly inconspicuous, and so it's kind of a predator deterrent. But again, smaller ear sizes, their eyes are still fairly large, but again, they have excellent senses of smell and they're well adapted for living in lawns and in the pasture settings and golf courses and again, they're active all year long.
Will they come into a home?
Very seldomly. Typically, a lot of the situations we're having with mice at home invasions are the white-footed deer mice and also the typical house mouse. But voles typically, because of the nature of where they live, their habits, they're not really an animal that you're going to find in in invading a home or invading a garage or something like that.
So it's going to be damage that you see outside, so you don't have to worry about it inside.
Very much so. And one of the things right now, because of the unseasonably warm weather in Utah, folks are calling and they're panicking about the vole damage, you know. And again, because they don't hibernate, had those lawns been covered with snow, those voles would have still been active. You know, you just wouldn't have seen it. And now that the snow is gone off the lawns, there's a lot of activity and folks are concerned about the tremendous damage that they're seeing, and also concerned about, you know, damage to fruiting trees and things like that with the girdling. The greatest damage to girdling typically will occur in areas where we've got good snow cover and the voles are active during the winter, and it'll occur under the snow line where there'll be girdling around those trees and in some cases causing tree mortality. But again, we are seeing peaks right now. We've got the last couple of years, the calls coming in and folks concerned about vole populations. And so it looks like right now we're at a peak population level, and I don't know how long these peaks will continue. Typically, they're cycles that may go 2, 4, 5 years, but a lot of that also depends on weather conditions.
And they can reproduce like rabbits. I mean, even more so. I mean, they produce a litter how often?
They are very prolific. You know, typically a vole mouse will, in about 60 days, will actually be capable of actually breeding and actually producing. And so the gestation period is very short.
3 to 10 pups every 3 weeks?
It's entirely possible in an ideal situation. But again, this
I'm just
is,
reading here. I'm like, right, I can't believe that.
Right. Well, this is an animal that also is, when you look at the food chain, they're kind of at the bottom of that food chain. And so coyotes, owls, hawks, weasels, a lot of animals really kind of depend on that. And so when you look at these peak cycles and things along that line, those animals that use those voles as a primary prey species, they tend to benefit, and they can, their populations can also respond accordingly. But then correspondingly, when the population drops, you know, those animals will tend to look at other food sources. And, you know, right now, voles are essentially providing that cornucopia, if you will, for wildlife food.
I know the owl population on the north side of Hyde Park is being very well fed right now, and we hear them every single night.
Right. I've been out in actually in some of the rural areas, and I'm seeing quite a bit of owls doing very well. And at the same time, as you walk through some of these pastures and some of these shrublands, you actually see voles, visibly as you're walking through, they will be scurrying it about. And so it's right now, from the standpoint of a lot of these predatory birds, it's a time of plenty.
So in my chicken coop, when I see at night something scurrying in and out of the food bin, am I looking at a mouse or am I looking at a vole?
You could be looking at deer mouse, and you could also be looking at voles. And again, it depends on the situation. In a case like that where you've got a food source available, you know, pet food, chicken food or something along that line, deer mice really, really benefit quite a bit from those types of things, and they can actually use those things to grow and sustain their population.
But just look to see if it has a long tail, then I'll know.
Right, right. It in a case like that, it might be more members of that family as opposed to the voles, because again, voles, they have burrows underground, and they have these characteristic tunnel ways or runways that folks see, and that's more typical of their particular habitat. They're more focusing on that green vegetation, if you will, where you know, something like a deer mouse can go from a little bit wider variety, and again, getting into dog food and things like that.
Do the voles carry any diseases?
There are diseases, but again, the chance of that happening, of that contact with human beings, just because we're not in close association with them and they're not, they don't frequent our houses, the risks are pretty low of folks contacting anything from them.
Well, let's talk about control methods. Number one, I would say get a cat.
Cats can actually,
I know, around our house, our cat is really good at being a predator on voles, and we see evidence all around the property of such.
Right, and they love to show off. They love to bring that
to play that, with it.
To play with it, or bring it and show you what great job they are doing. But with voles, depending on the situation, again, with any of these animals we're dealing with, there's really a three-step process, and the first is always looking at exclusion? Is there something I can do to exclude them from the area? With voles, you know, you're really kind of limited in terms of what you can do. Then the next thing you start looking at is something called habitat modification or sanitation. And so is there something in the area that I can do differently that might make the area less attractive? With lawns, typically one of the things is that if you've got a lawn that hasn't been dethatched and it's very, very thick and very, very luscious and you keep the grass height quite high, you might want to think about some preventive measures going into the fall where you reduce the grass height and you basically remove that thatch so you don't create a situation of providing that protection. Now, obviously, in more drier climates, you know, one of the things we talk about is keeping the grass a little bit higher so that you reduce the evapotranspiration. And so, you know, folks in Idaho have expressed concern about, gosh, if I do that, then, you know, my lawn's going to die. You know, I'm going to have to water more. And so there's obviously a trade-out. Other times, if you've got situations where you have undeveloped or more wild-type areas adjacent, you know, a well-manicured lawn, voles will move in from those areas into lawns to seek those green groceries. And so there's been some success with using buffer strips where, in fact, what you do is you create a 10-foot or wider area where there's no vegetation, and it creates basically a barrier, if you will, for vole migration into those areas. The last measure, again, is population reduction. You know, what are you going to do? In most of these cases, in some of the smaller lawns and areas, I still think your best bet is using some type of wooden-based snap mouse or rat trap. You're going to have to be vigilant. You're going to have to put it out there, and you're going to have to catch the population and remove those and continually bait those traps using something like peanut butter or something along that line. A lot of folks like the solution where they go to the farm and garden store, nursery store, and they buy the poison peanuts or something and they dump it in the hole and thinking that's going to do it. Again, you're dealing with an animal that typically forages out and about, and so they're looking for seeds, they're looking for vegetation, and so that may not be the best solution. And again, when you start using baits in an urban setting, you need to be concerned about cats, dogs, and children getting into those baits. In a larger agricultural field, however, there are some baits that are registered that are spread across the landscape that have been very, very effective, and the technique of applying those also mitigates the impact in non-target species, such as birds that may come in the area and be wanting to pick up the seeds.
I've seen these traps made from PVC pipe. They're kind of T-shaped. You put the bait in through the top, and it's small enough that a cat, and long enough that a cat or whatever you don't want to get in there can't get in there, and then the vole will go in and pull it out. Are those effective at all?
That is. That's a very excellent solution. And the idea of the bait station is that you want to restrict access to the animal you're going to target. There's some really, really good designs on our website that talk about baiting these traps. But the other part about it that you need to consider, if you're doing those kind of things, access to children in those areas. And mm-hmm. So even though you put a bait station out and consider it child-proof, if you've got kids in the area that can play with those things and can remove those, you need to really think about the measures to ensure that they don't get access to those. But those kind of bait stations that can restrict access just to the target animal can be very, very effective. But again, you need to think about the surrounding environment if that's going to cause a problem for other folks in the area. So,
is there an issue for other wildlife who eat the vole after it's eaten the bait? Does it absorb the?
No, that's the nice thing about it. Typically, one of the main registering baits is a zinc phosphide bait, which is absorbed into the tissues, and so the secondary toxicity is very low. Zinc phosphide in its as a compound is toxic to a lot of animals to some degree, and so it depends on the quantity being ingested. And so when using these kind of things, the applications are done at areas where you've got the minimum amount of possibility that, for example, birds might go in the area and might be picking up those seeds. Yeah. And so there are some strict precautions. They are restricted use baits, and so they need to be applied only by applicators that are certified. And so if folks have any questions about those applications, they can either contact me or their local county extension office, and we can really help you work through that.
So what are you looking for when you go into the store and want to get some bait for voles?
Well, there's a lot of variety of different baits available. Some of the baits that have proven fairly effective in these bait stations are some of the new generation anticoagulant baits, and these are baits that typically are durable. They're baits that don't have this restriction on them, and they can be placed in one of these bait boxes. And essentially, what they do is the animal will come in, it'll nibble on it, it'll take a lethal dose, and it'll succumb to it. And the secondary effects are also minimal, but they do provide a long duration, a weather resistant type of bait that can actually provide control for one or more seasons.
Now, is there more information you've got a website that we've talked about before, Wild Aware Utah.
Right. There's a website out there called Wild Aware Utah, and Wild Aware Utah is a joint partnership between Utah Hogle Zoo, the Division of Wildlife Resources, and Utah State University Extension. And so if you Google Wild Aware Utah, you'll go to that site and you'll get all kinds of information about how to live with wildlife in our backyards, how to live with wildlife in the outdoors, and how to understand the relationship between humans and wildlife, and how in some cases some of the actions we do might be inadvertently creating some of the conflicts that we're seeing.
Okay. Terry, thank you so much for coming in.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to our Living with Wildlife segment. Terry Messmer is USU's Extension Wildlife Specialist, and we'll have him back on again. Coming up next is our Petals and Prose segment with Helen Cannon. Learn all about petunias.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and as I said the last time I was with you, I wanted to spend a little time with a book called A Garden of Marvels by Ruth Kassinger, and this chapter is called Black Petunias. And quite a long while ago, I really hated petunias. I told my family if they planted petunias on my grave, I would come back and haunt them. Well, I've changed my mind about petunias, as petunias themselves have changed from being a rather insipid and ubiquitous flower. So I will read Black Petunias. The only flowering plants my mother ever grew were petunias, which she put in large pots by the front door. They delighted me as a child with their simple open trumpets in uncomplicated colors, a pure white, a pink, the color of the hostess snowballs, crayon red, a bright purple, the shade of my favorite party dress. It was my job to pinch off the spent blooms, which my mother had said encouraged more flowering. The leaves were unpleasantly sticky, but the petals were softer than velvet and infinitely lighter in weight. They seemed friendly flowers, eager to please. All summer they blithely spilled flower after flower as if inspired by their own naive delight in the season. This author likes to anthropomorphize, so she really talks about plants as beings. The petunias I'm looking at today in the gardens of Ball Horticultural Company headquarters outside West Chicago are not my mother's petunias. No such petals ever unfolded in her pots by the front door. These petals are black, completely and utterly black, without the slightest pentimento of deep purple that you find in other reportedly black flowers. The only color here is in the deepest depths of its trumpet. It is a single dot of brilliant yellow. It is as if all sun-sent photons that ever had the misfortune to approach this black hole of a bloom had been sucked down its throat and were distilled in its depths. It is a day in late August. I am in these spectacular gardens waiting to see Dr. J.M. Ping Ren, the breeder of the black petunia. I had found her petunias at the entrance to the garden, commingled with a large pot with pure white and lipstick red varieties. I can't imagine who would want a garden full of black petunias. other than a funeral home operator, but in this mixture, the effect is striking. In a Madam X kind of way, black petunias can be very sexy. Dr. Wren finds me, and together we walk back through the garden and across the lobby. She has agreed to show me her breeding greenhouses, and we'll have to drive about 20 minutes to get there. Ping, as she insists I call her, has thick black haircut in a pixie style, a brilliant and ready smile, an energetic stride, and an English that is fluent, if just a little eccentric. She's charmingly candid. She is also one of the country's foremost plant breeders and is responsible for Ball's Petunia Program, one of the company's biggest selling product groups. Ping came to the United States after finishing her undergraduate work in 1998 in China. After earning a PhD from Cornell, she started at Ball in 2001, breeding the traditional petunias I knew from my childhood. She joined the long list of breeders who have been manipulating and improving petunias for almost 200 years. In 1834, a British nurseryman named Atkins created the garden petunia, Hybrida, when he crossed two species that had recently been shipped from South America. One, Petunia axillaris, now has an upright habit and white flowers that have a long, narrow tube, something like trumpets that medieval heralds play. Axillaris emits a scent that attracts its primary pollinator, the hawk moth, which has a long proboscis capable of reaching the nectar produced in the deep tube. The other species is Petunia integrifolia, which has a ground-hugging habit, violet-purple flowers with short, wide tubes and no color and no scent, can maneuver their big bodies comfortably into the wide tube. The tube also serves as a pied-à-terre for trysting insects. In the wild, two species do not produce hybrids, even when they grow in the same area. Hawk moths are active only at dusk, and relying on fragrance, rarely stumble into the scentless integrifolia. Most bees cannot fit into the narrow axillaris tube. Small bees do occasionally visit both species' flowers during the day, so one would expect that at least a few hybrid seeds would set. But without the breeder's intervention, they rarely do. Why not? The two species are compatible enough that pollen grains of both species send out pollen tubes no matter which of the two species' stigmas they land on. But when both integrifolia pollen and axillaria pollen fall on axillaria stigmas, the pollen tubes of axillaris always grow faster and win the race, down to the style and the ovary. Likewise, integrifolia stigmas, integrifolia tubes, always beat axillaria tubes. This advantage is part of what makes a species. There are many possible barriers to hybridization. Incomparable chromosome numbers is the biggest one, but between these two petunia species, homospecificity of pollen is the stopper. Only when a breeder or a lab ensures there is no competition do the two species hybridize. By 1837, Joseph Harrison was writing in the English Floricultural Cabinet magazine that breeders had produced many charming color variations from crosses of the two species made in the greenhouse, including pale pink with dark center, sulfur, a deep pink with a dark center, white with a dark center, and others streaked and veined. Since that time, breeders around the world have tinkered with Atkins hybrid and made it one of the world's most popular garden plants. By repeated crossings, careful selections, and inbreeding, plus the occasional fortuitous mutation, they have changed the simple purple and white petunias radically. Now some varieties have double the number of petals or edges so deeply frilled that they are hard to recognize as petunia blossoms. Breeders have coaxed yellows out of the gene pool and fashioned a host of patterns including stripes, stars, bicolors, streaks, freckles, contrasting edges, and morns that slide from hue to hue like a Turner sunset. In 1837, Harrison was impressed by Petunia corollas, the petals collectively, that had grown to 3 inches in diameter. 20th century breeders have bred blossoms as broad as 7 inches. Petunias now flower more prolifically and branch more abundantly, tolerate drought better, are more resistant to fungi. Their soft petals, once easily damaged in a hard rain, are sturdier. Until 20 years ago, however, one trait continued to be the same. All petunias on the market had upright growth habit. Then, in 1995, Ball introduced a new type of petunia, a spreading petunia called Wave. Developed by a breeder at Karen Brewing Company in Japan, Wave opened an entirely new market for the petunia as a full-season flowering ground cover. Put one Wave petunia in a garden, and it will cover 4-foot diameter area in blossoms. In 2001, when Ping, that's P-I-N-G, arrived at Ball, Wave was where the action was in petunias. I'd like to continue with this next time I can be with you. So listen in. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.